You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
So there you go.
Nice.
In my face.
Yeah, in your face.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Let me give you a great angle for your story. We come in here every day at the crack of dawn because we care. We care about providing you with a proper quality education. We're good people. Thank you, the end, good night, and good luck. What else can I help you with?
Everybody. Wow, my camera there was not working. No, I wouldn't be surprised if I just check out of this podcast today. Things are just not going well on this end. Anyway, hello, everybody. It is episode 169 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hey, everybody.
And also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely-ho, Skywalkerinos.
Mm-hmm.
We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Today's big recommend is Bad Education.
Everybody loves the Skywalker.
Let's go on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Jeremy, what you got?
Oh, boy. Let's start out nice and light. Cheery. I caught the new HBO documentary Surviving Ohio State, executive produced by one George Clooney. Let me start by saying this is a heavy fucking watch. So know that going in. It's sobering to learn details that I personally had not ever come across regarding the scope of this scandal and cover-up, and ironically would make a really morbid good double feature for Bad Education in the way that so many people at Ohio State kept going out of their way to cover up the abuse for the sake of the school, for the sake of our reputation, for the sake of our students. Just some bullet points that were shockingly new to me. 177 known victims of this Dr. Strauss man. That's only the ones who came forward. They suspect it was likely thousands over 20 plus years. This is a man who was known by everyone in male athletics to shower with athletes and stay in the shower for more than an hour as athletes came and went. He once got out of the shower when the athletes were done, was halfway dressed, and another group of athletes came in to shower, and he went back in the shower and claimed he had missed a spot. This is a man who did a hernia test on virtually any male patient he saw, regardless of why they were there. There's a hockey player in this documentary who takes a puck off his foot and goes to see this man. And the first thing the man does is touch his crotch for a hernia test.
In quotes, hernia test. The things he's doing during the hernia test are not a hernia test.
Are not hernia test.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A man in the documentary says he told Representative Jim Jordan about it, and Jim Jordan said, "It's Strauss. You know what he does." The cover-up by the university is almost somehow just as awful as the abuse itself. They knew about it as early as 1979. And he wasn't suspended until the late 90s. But even when he was suspended, he continued to see university patients off campus. Anyway, I was floored. I was sobered. It made me very angry. And I can't help but think this is going on or has gone on at other places we've yet to learn about. It's on HBO. It's a fantastic documentary from a filmmaking standpoint. But again, heavy topic. Not easy to watch, but I do recommend it.
Yeah, I love these, like, oh, you know how that person is type of waving away of things, because then it puts the onus on the victims immediately. Like, it's like, you knew this person was like this,
yeah.
So why did you go towards them or whatever? Like, why can't we go after the person who's like this? Why can't we eradicate that problem? You know, so
yeah, it's there are a couple moments in the doc that I watched yesterday, knowing you were going to chat about it today, and that I wanted to highlight. But it's worth mentioning before that, as you mentioned it going on elsewhere, this is the third high profile, almost exact case like this that we've seen in the last little bit with the gymnast trainer and from Michigan State, so another college. Employed person, and then the Penn State stuff as well was another college employed person who was in charge of the physical well-being of these student athletes. Two of the points that really stood out to me was a point that was made over and over again about how, because it were these big guy wrestlers, that nobody believed them, that it was like, well, why don't you just knock them out? A bunch of these guys, I've seen these guys take people down, like they're gonna let some guy do that to them, and just completely misunderstanding power dynamics of psychology. Right, their physical power dynamics and their psychological power dynamics, and people sometimes don't understand you know, how those apply to each other in that way. And the other thing was how it went into the cover-up, and just that to this day, these people are still trying to get justice against Ohio State.
Five current lawsuits still going on.
So it was kind of mind-blowing to me. I mean, I'm sure they talked to their lawyers and were like, you know, can I do this documentary? Can I sit for an interview? Like, it's, but, you know, just to be able to tell their stories even as this is ongoing is, I think, really, really important. It needs to be heard. We need to hear these stories as hard as they are. So that we can affect change, so that the next person knows I do need to be stronger. It was only, this documentary is so infuriating. It was only until a non-athlete turned him in that things really started to change, because the non-athlete didn't have a job to lose, didn't have a scholarship to lose or anything like that. And it's just, there's just so much of that stuff in this doc. It's worth watching for sure.
Aaron, what do you got?
Hard to follow that up, but I will do it with a Brazilian silent film from the 1930s called La Mite. This is almost as fascinating behind the scenes as it is on the screen. This was a 22-year-old Brazilian philosopher, if you can say at that age even, but somebody who was, you know, very thinky, and he was like, oh, I like movies, I'm gonna put something together. It was the only film he ever made.
Wow.
And it was almost lost to time. But what it is, it tells us a story of two women and a man who are adrift in a boat. And the movie tells each of their stories and how they got to this boat, and ask the question as it leaves them floating in the ocean adrift, is it worth it to escape what they escaped, to be floating adrift in an ocean? And there's some really interesting thought things going on here. There's some really interesting editing and shot combination to give tone. And I was really impressed with this movie. And it's kind of one of those to dig up. I know Scorsese was pretty key in its restoration. There still is one, they think, 5-minute chunk that is missing from the movie. And there are a couple parts where what they do have is really worn. But it's on Criterion. It's well worth a watch. I believe La Mite means like limits in Portuguese and the idea of what are the human limits? What limits are we willing to go to escape the things we hate, those kind of things. So, I was really fascinated by this. It's a nice, easy one to pop on Criterion and feel.
Never have heard of this. I have to check this one out. You've been on quite the kick, haven't you? Going way back. Is this something you've been just doing, or is it a coincidence?
Generally, when I tick off my watch list, I will tick off the borders. So anything in the current year will go first. I'll tick that off, and then I'll go back to the earliest part of my watch list. So I just refreshed my watch list. I just got through the previous watch list, so I refreshed with a bunch of stuff, and so that's why I'm in the 20s and 30s right now, kind of checking some stuff off. So yeah.
Nice. My small recommend is definitely probably truly a small recommend. It's called Stick. It's on Apple TV, and I think in particular you two would love Stick because it's a golf comedy sitcom type of thing. And also Jeremy, the character in question, who is getting trained to be a pro golfer, is from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
So oh, neat.
I just thought that you might find that interesting.
I do.
But Stick, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not a great show. This isn't like Sopranos level show here. This is just a decent airy thing that you can watch, 30 minute episodes and everything. And Owen Wilson plays a former pro golfer who happens upon this prodigy who, of course, doesn't want to play golf because of reasons. And then he ends up trying to find a way to recruit him and get him into golf. And apparently he was super into golf when he was younger, but his dad was overbearing and basically drove him out of the sport. So now Owen Wilson kind of has to fight the same kind of things that this kid's father was putting on him when he's trying to make him good and everything. And of course we see this guy, and the very first few episodes is the recruitment, the trying to gain the trust, and also going through these amateur tours. I don't understand them as much as you guys do, but like going through these like basically tryouts to get to the major amateur tour or whatever, and like and dealing with like, you know, what are you how are you going to play? You're going to be he's kind of like Kevin Costner in Tin Cup, this kid, a little bit, because he's cocky and he's like he wants to hit the ball as far as he can, and it's like people trying to rein him in and all that type of stuff. But anyway, I think this is funny enough. Mark Maron is in it. He's funny. I mean Owen Wilson's always likable, but I think overall this is a fun show that if you kind of like golf or you really love golf, you might really like this show. So I'm recommending it. I've seen there's 5 episodes so far. I don't know how many more there are going to be, but so far, and I'm enjoying it. So nice. There you go.
Nice. In my face.
Yeah, in your face. All right, let's go on to our big recommend, which is Bad Education, and this is Jeremy's pick. So, Jeremy, take us away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Bad Education is a cinematic telling of real events in a fancy New York public school system where a superintendent and his assistant and more were caught embezzling. I just wanted to point out this is a true story because that, while the movie is entertaining, let's just remember this really happened and probably happening all over the country. The movie opens on a school board parent rally meeting with an unseen MC extolling the virtues of the school and its leadership, listing off elite colleges their students have gone on to, while we watch Hugh Jackman's Frank preen in a mirror. He then walks to the stage and is introduced to huge applause. Next, we see the beginning of a school day at Rosalind High School as Frank enters with his coffee and greets lots of students and workers. It's clear he's very well liked by most everyone here. We meet Allison Janney's Pam,
who is apparently has a new office, a new title, and a new husband, and she is Frank's assistant. It's shown that she's very competent and anticipates her boss's questions and needs. And the movie is going to show you all the shine before slowly revealing what's underneath it. Before you can even enter his office, Frank is waylaid by a parent with a gripe. She's pissed because a teacher wouldn't let her son take a piss and ended up almost pissing himself. He diffuses the situation by listening and responding with genuine and charming conversation. So the movie is working very hard to show you he's very good at his job, everyone likes him. And the people that don't like him, he wins them over pretty quickly. As we tour Frank's office later, we learn he apparently met Geraldo and is obsessed with lengthening his lifespan, if you judge by his magazine subscriptions. When a student, Rachel, knocks on Pam's door, Frank offers to help her. She just needs a pull quote for the student newspaper. He talks to her about the skywalk they're building to help the students get from one building to the other. Frankly, it's absurd that this is even something everyone's excited about building. Like, from the get-go, the skywalk sounds like the least necessary thing for a school ever. She thanks him and comments about this article just being a puff piece, when Frank then gives some of the most regrettable good advice he will give in his entire life by telling her it's only a puff piece if you let it be a puff piece, and a real journalist can turn a puff piece into a story. Next, we meet Ray Romano's school board president, Big Bob Spicer. He just can't believe how much people are paying for houses in the area just to send their kids to this school system. There's an interesting moment here, too, where the school board members, where Frank is momentarily distracted by a woman's expensive jewelry instead of what she is saying. On the bleachers later, Frank muses to Pam about how much Big Bob Spicer might make at his day job. He talks about maybe skipping book club tonight, but Pam reminds him the women at book club adore him, and they all tell two dozen other people about him. They also talk about the next budget vote for the skywalk, and she disgustingly feeds him a bite of her pastrami sandwich. After book club, the host mother basically comes on to Frank, but he pulls away and plays with his wedding ring, saying her memory is still very fresh, when the opposite is true. Then he goes back to the office and finds Pam working late. So they do some drills where she tells him students' last names and he tries to tell her everything he knows about that student. The next scene, we see that pay off when he's meeting the parents of all these students, impressing them with his intimate knowledge of their kids' classes and interests. And I'm not sure he's the greatest, but this guy is a pretty good showman. We next get Rachel asking Pam about contract bids and the Skywalk Bridge. Pam pushes back a bit, says the Skywalk is a great project, and then she gives some PR sound bites. Undeterred, Rachel asks if Pam has the bids handy, but they're in the basement. Undeterred, Rachel says she has next period free, so Pam reluctantly gives her the key. While Jenny, Pam's niece, makes copies for Rachel of the paper she found in the basement, Rachel fixates on a disgusting leaky ceiling tile and is told, "It's an old building, so we get leaks sometimes." This doesn't appear to make much sense to Rachel. Next thing you know, we're in Vegas, baby, where some people are having fun and gambling, but Frank is attending an educators' conference. After a speaker finishes, Frank stares at the pastries and the carbs he is not allowing himself to eat these days. He goes to a bar for a drink and ends up recognizing the bartender as a former student named Kyle. Next, they go to dinner together and are catching up. Not long after that, they are in Frank's hotel suite, and after some light conversation, Kyle approaches and kisses Frank, and we are led to believe they do the sexy time. Rachel returns home with some pizza for dinner, and her dad asks about her day. He muses about the school looking for someone in development, and she says, "You're overqualified." And all we know at this point seems to be that he has lost his job. Later, in the dark, Pam is deleting items from a spreadsheet when she's startled by the janitor. We cut to her hosting a party at her awesome house on the water as her friends suggest her husband must be making bank. Jenny, Pam's niece, asks if there's any way Pam could help her get a PlayStation for her kid. She promises to pay it back. Pam says, "Just put it on the card. It'll be reconciled at the end of the month. I've been doing this a long time." Rachel's editor thinks her story is too complex and not the style of the paper, and he changes her headline to be a puff piece headline. Back at Pam's house, we see a man taking measurements before he goes to a hardware store and makes a large purchase. He then visits several other stores of the same chain, making large purchases, all with a Roslyn Public Schools credit card. An ACE employee suggests the volume of his purchases across several stores qualifies him for a preferred account that would include direct shipping. However, an ACE hardware employee connected to Big Bob Spicer suspects something is amiss because the guy used a home address and not the school's address, so he brings his concerns to Bob. They do some simple, basic discussing and realize that the name on the card is someone related to Pam, and the next morning, they're waiting for her in the office. Frank is actually, at the time, sitting in a beanbag chair, surveying sixth graders about their experiences, but is interrupted by a concerned secretary. Then we cut to an emergency meeting where board members are discussing calling the cops or the mayor, while Frank stares silently into space. He says, "I should have caught this." Meanwhile, Jenny confesses to Pam she spent a lot more money with that card than just a PlayStation. And Pam says, "Don't worry, Frank will fix it." Jim, the school's auditor, Phil, the school's auditor, is looking over the books and losing his shit. He reveals to Frank that Pam took $223,000 that they know of, but the real amount is certainly a lot higher. Frank goes back to the school board and tells them the sum total is $250,000. And initially, they're all angry and want to turn her in. But Frank makes a plea that they keep it quiet to preserve the school's image and its future funding and chances of their school's kids getting accepted by awesome colleges. He even ties in the future of the area property values. This is how cover-ups work. It works, and he sells them on the plan to keep it quiet, have Pam pay them back, and have her resign and sign an NDA. She's confused. Frank says, "You stole from the school, Pam." She still looks confused and shocked. After she leaves, she repeatedly calls Frank, but Frank doesn't answer. And if you've been paying attention, I bet you can guess why. Instead, he calls Kyle and tells him he just wanted to hear his voice. Pam drives home in her Corvette and screams at her son who used the card at all the hardware stores. She tells her family, "I stole, we all did," and then she actually puts some of the blame for her theft on her family members. The next day, while cleaning out her office, Pam is approached by Rachel, looking for the basement key again. Pam asks what she's looking for. Rachel says the Skywalk is super expensive, considering everything that's falling apart in the school. She also says there was also a pizza oven. And Pam snaps at her and says there's nothing to find. After reminding Pam the purchase orders are public record, Rachel is finally given the key. Pam tries to get Frank's attention when he arrives, but Frank completely ignores her and locks his office door. Pam grabs her box of personal items and storms out. Later, Frank has a meeting with Jenny. He says they want to transition her to the special utilities department. He promises they're just doing some shuffling of personnel. She then threatens to tell the world about the firing of Pam because she does not know who she's talking to. He stops her in her tracks by complimenting the necklace she's wearing, which he's pretty sure is new. Now Jenny has no leverage and accepts the reassignment, and yes, her new office is in the basement and it sucks. When the school board spins Pam's absence as something due to a serious disease, people start sending Pam baskets and flowers and offering her money. But the board makes just a quick statement about her leaving at the next meeting and then immediately moves on to a graph of how many of their students are at kick-ass colleges. Rachel begins making the rounds, offering donuts to construction company employees as she tries to track down the truth about all the bids for the Skywalk, while Frank has a cosmetic procedure done to his face. When Rachel's dad comes into her room and to tell her it's time for dinner and sees what she's working on, he realizes she's onto something and asks, "Have you called any of these companies?" Frank and his new surgery scar wake up next to Kyle, and he has to get going. But Kyle suggests Frank should maybe consider moving to Vegas. Rachel takes her father's advice, and he assists her, and they start calling the companies on these bids and invoices. One of the numbers rings at Pam's husband's workplace, and he hangs up once he realizes who the man was trying to actually call. So now we know both Pam and her husband were in on the racket, and this is why he didn't have any problem when she came home and said, "I got fired for stealing." Rachel decides to go to the physical address of a company that has billed the school over $800,000. Don't do this if you're a minor, because people who steal lots of money are often willing to do some pretty serious shit to keep it quiet. But Rachel knocks on the door and a man answers the door, and it's clearly just someone's apartment. Confused, she leaves, but on the way out, she sees Frank as the elevator doors open. And though she tries to hide from him down the hall, he sees her as well before she runs out. And exactly how many men is Frank keeping on the side right now? Frank struggles to focus on his book reading now that he has been caught. Rachel presents her findings to her editor, who initially balks because Frank is writing his college recommendation letter, and we start to see how Frank has made himself so important to so many aspects of this school to be in the position of power to be able to steal. Anyway, he finally then asks Rachel if she's sure she wants to do this. But she is, of course. She's a good journalist. We cut to her sitting outside, looking at her article, contemplating her article, and Frank walks up. We already know Frank to be a pretty damn good manipulator, and he knows his mere presence will startle her, and it does. He says he's not upset, but he wants to know why she was there. And she tells him it's for something she's writing. And he starts to give her the whole, "you have so much potential, but you need to be careful" thing. He basically says if she goes public, it could come back around and harm her. He then stands and moves to sit on the same bench as her, which is a total power move. He calls her article a mistake, and if she makes it, it will ruin the future of the school and its students. This is the same spin he gave the board about Pam. Rachel, to her credit, does not respond at all, and it's kind of insane he walks away thinking that this has worked. I guess he's just used to it working. Phil, the accountant auditor guy, comes to Frank and tells him the Pam thing is way more than $250,000. He also tells Frank there was this huge charge for Frank's own flight on the Concorde to Europe for two seats that basically cost $20,000. He eventually asks, "Who's Kyle Contreras?" Frank laughs nervously and then goes on the offensive and says, "So that's how you want to play it?" He reminds Phil of Phil's own funky math in the past and how Phil should have caught Pam's theft, and he bullies Phil into promising to drop it. And then we have a nice scene with Rachel and her dad where we learn that he had been fired for not turning in his friends that were doing insider trading. And while he had not been doing insider trading himself, he takes responsibility for not speaking up and seems regretful. Frank, who still thinks he's in the clear, is again shown preening and doing his beauty routine. He then goes to the school and finds everyone staring at him because, dun dun dun, Rachel's article has dropped and everyone is reading it and looking at him with disdain. Frank tries to plead his case, telling Big Bob he did it for the school. And Bob says, "No, you did it because you like to look pretty." Frank then tries arguing himself as an educator, not a greedy man, because I chose to teach and not go to Wall Street. Bob tells him they've scheduled a meeting, they're going to make it public, which, as an aside, is kind of weird to me. It's all over the school. It's obviously public already. But whatever. As a last gasp, he yells to Bob, "I can still get your daughter into Harvard." But Bob merely says he wishes him peace and leaves. Somehow, instead of leaving, Frank ends up in front of an auditorium full of angry parents trying to get them to vote for the budget and forgive his misdeeds. I don't even understand how he was allowed back on campus. He seeks solace in his office that is still somehow his, only to find the concerned parent from earlier and her son. The teacher that she was angry about had continued treating her son poorly after the last meeting. The kid tries to read a letter he wrote to Frank, but Frank gets upset when the kid can't pronounce the word accelerated. He gets out of control, and when the mother calls him on it, he goes off on her, still believing himself to be a noble educator. Pam enjoys a cigarette on the beach as the authorities arrive at her house. We then see them questioning her, and they strongly imply if she helps them go after more fraud, they could keep her family out of trouble. Frank then suddenly shows up at Kyle's house unannounced, but Kyle's overjoyed to see him because Kyle is naive and Frank is a liar. They go out for the night, and Kyle convinces Frank to dance with him. We see Pam driving and then handing over tons of files to the authorities. We then see Jenny get arrested and Phil getting arrested before we catch back up with Frank and Kyle arriving home from the club. Frank hears the sirens approaching before Kyle does and says there's $30,000 in the top drawer of the dresser. Kyle doesn't understand what's going on and keeps asking what's going on, and eventually Frank gets out of the car and is tackled and arrested. We see Frank's husband being questioned, who says, "We printed pamphlets and handbooks for the school and such," and he takes all the blame for being the sole employee of the fictional company and says Frank knew nothing about it. But he's devastated when told of and shown proof of Frank's relationship with Kyle. At court, we see Frank brought in to a scowling gallery that includes Rachel, good for her, and he takes his seat as the defendant. No one is really spared from collateral damage, as even Big Bob has dog shit left on his doorstep. But we do see the workers at the school finally cleaning out the old moldy ceiling tiles. We see Rachel at a desk with an editor nameplate. And finally, we see Frank in his prison cell, where he still reads fine literature and does a full preening routine in front of a mirror. In the final scene, Frank is in a common area and hears Voice giving a speech, and it's basically the voice from the beginning that was introducing him at the rally, and he moves towards it, but he's just hallucinating, being back at the school, about to be announced to a throng of supporters. As he comes on stage, they chant, number one, and give a standing ovation as Frank's smile turns rotten. And that is Bad Education. What did you guys think of Bad Education?
I love this movie. This was kind of a, I know it's, is this a, it's 2019, right? I feel like I watched this during 2020 when there was like very little in the way of going out and everything at the time. And it was one of those surprise good movies that came out during that period of time. You know, I you can look at this movie several different ways because it's got several different aspects to it. And the first thing that I love about this is that it plays on your like of Hugh Jackman so much that you are willing to believe that he's not doing anything all the way through this. Like he's, they even get to a point where you're like, oh, it's Allison Janney who was the real crook the whole time.
Yeah.
And you just kind of like, yeah. So, but then there's like all this movie left over. Why is there this movie left over after this? And so like it plays on that. And so you're willing to think of him as a good guy for a really long time in this. I mean, some people are probably like, that guy's crooked right off the beginning, but like, but yeah, it's just one of those things that I love about the aspect of this movie. Another great thing about this is just the character study that is Frank, because everything about him is he can't be himself, right? Like everything. He can't just age gracefully or, you know, he has to have this, facade at all times. So he gets all these facelifts. He can't eat carbs. He's trying to, he's the face of this, region, to try to get them money over and over again. And he can't, he obviously can't be gay in public either. That's another thing. Even in New York, you can't do that. So like everything about him is kind of a lie, and like, you can tell it's somewhere in there is an amazing educator, but it's someone who lost patience a long time ago with everybody else going out and getting the money and the glory. And so for some people, that's part of the deal. In fact, for most of these people, it's part of the deal. Mm. They know they're not going to get money. They know they're not going to get glory. But for some people, it's just not enough. And for him, that's what happens. That's when he starts sliding, whenever that started, you know, probably in the 90s or whatever. Mm. It probably started for him where, you know, if I skim off the top a little bit, nobody's going to notice. Oh, I can skim even more. Okay, nobody's going to. Now everybody in the town is benefiting from what I'm doing. How would they ever say no to this if they just because I'm taking a little bit of money. Look at where their kids are going. Look at how high their homes are going for when they're selling it. You know, that is exactly, you know, you mentioned in there, it's exactly how a cover-up happens. Mm-hmm. Is when you involve so many people who would otherwise call you out on your bullshit, but then realize how much they have to lose mm-hmm. in the end. I think they do a really good job of building all of that and everything. But yeah, in that very end scene, that end scene with the kid and their mom, you can see exactly what happened to him right there. People coming in thinking their kids are a lot more special than they are. And why can't you teach them? And you're the one that's responsible for this. And you know, like, you know what? Sometimes your kid isn't a Harvard material, and that's okay. And that's sometimes what people don't get through their heads in all of this. And but again, most people would be patient with this and just say, well, we'll just keep on trying and see what happens. Not this guy. This guy takes it as a personal affront when you don't know certain things. And yes, clearly the mom wrote the letter. He doesn't know the word accelerate when he gets to it. Accelerated. He wants to go into an accelerated program and doesn't know the word accelerated. You know, it's one of those type of things that he's probably dealt with 100 times.
Yeah.
Whereas most people just say, yeah, we'll keep on trying to do the best for your son and everything. He goes on this long rant about a race car and finally gets him to say the word accelerate right, you know, because it obviously irks him so much that the kid can't say the word right. I love how that character is built in this. The other part of this is the investigative journalism part of this. The reason why a lot of time it seems like we never question why a certain entity out there is doing so much better than everybody else. We never question it. We'll never question whether or not there might be a crime involved behind all of this. When one school system suddenly shoots themselves up this meteoric rise from nothing to number 4, I believe they're at, in the entire, is it the country? Or is it the
They were
New
actually
York
in real life, they got up to number 6 in the country. They were the number 6
it's
ranked
in the
high
country,
school in the country.
So they're trying to get to number 1 in the country with the Skywalk, which again, I don't know how that factors into being, and maybe it's just the fact that they have so much money and that people are just willing to go and move to this place because of the reputation it has or whatever, but there's a reason why a lot of these newspapers and media outlets don't go after these people. And it's, they don't want to know about that. They think that there's a lot to be said about the reason why our media is controlled by all these rich people. Now they don't want to know. They don't want to investigate these things that's the capitalistic society. This is a positive story. Why should we ever ruin that? That's the American way. And so of course nobody looks into it when stuff like this, like it's ridiculous when you read it, like what they're doing, how much money they're getting, what they're building with it. And nobody wants to go and investigate it. And you're right. You know, this girl Rachel walks in just wanting a stupid quote about the Skywalk, and he comes in and he's like, you know, there's not any just puff pieces. You know, you want to go out, again, showing how great he is as an educator, mm-hmm. showing like, you know, like, hey, go out there and find the story. He doesn't think she's going to find
his
the
stuff.
Big story. Yeah, but he does think that the story can be better than what it is. And of course, yeah, she goes and investigates and does the work. That's the problem. Another problem with journalism is that you have to do the work. You have to go in there and read some very boring things and find something and then make calls and ask questions and be a bad guy. And that's not in a lot of people's DNA. They have to go and like be an asshole to a lot of people, trying to be as nice as possible, but But anyway, I love the investigative journalism aspect of this because it shows very much kind of like an All the President's Men or something like that, how you do an investigation, how you do a journalistic thing. And so I love that aspect of it too. And so, yeah, this is a great movie. I really, 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 I think I liked it better this time than I did when I first watched it.
Yeah, this is an incredible watch. It's perfectly paced. The information is given so well. Chris, you hit my main two things. I'll just touch on them briefly again. The way it delivers its information is so important. The way it holds the information about his, you know, double dealings and other things is so important, not just to trick us, not just to have a whammy, not just to have a twist, but because it's important to the story that we understand how he is perceived, and not just perceived, but there's an authenticity to him being a good educator. Mm-hmm. By all accounts, Frank was a great educator. Like, he got stuff done. He provided a good environment for students to excel. Like, the fact that people contain multitudes is not something we should be scared of. We shouldn't be scared of the fact that somebody can be good at their job and also a terrible person skimming money from the school they pretend to be more concerned about. And I think the movie knows that and therefore gives us an opportunity to really see this person as, you know, a shining example in a few scenes before we find out, you know, what's really going on. I think that's really important. And then the other thing you mentioned that I also wanted to bring up is the journalism part. I am such a sucker for a journalism movie and journalism storylines. It is partially my personality, my curiosity. I've always been a very curious person. You know, I'm always interested in how things work and what's the inner workings of something. And journalists take that and look into the world, and they are always, always willing to ask why and how. They're always willing to really get to the bottom of those questions. And the fact that he gives her that speech of what it means to be a journalist, and he's so right, and it comes back to him is in my opinion, the best part of the movie and the story. I also wanted to mention the bookending scenes with the little boy. I think they're, you know, purposely a way to show us the two different versions of this personality type. Yep. And what they're going with. Chris, what you said is so true. My understanding of the real Frank was also that he just thought he deserved that money. Like, that it was for what he was able to do. He's like, I deserve to get paid like this. And so I'm going to make it happen if the system's not going to make it happen. That was kind of his
approach. Surprised how much theft happens because someone thinks they deserve it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the human ability to rationalize and narrativize the world around them is astounding. I mean, it's just story after story of, you know, people who just, well, this is how I saw the world, and I'm not a bad person. This is just the way it is, you know. You hear it in story after story.
Is it wrong to steal a loaf of bread to feed your family, Bart? Is it?
I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about, as you dig into the real part of the story, some differences that I think are valuable to bring up. I will say that I don't hold it against a movie for changing things, dramatization. I really don't. The important part is for the audience to know going in, when you see a dramatization of true events, don't ever expect that's exactly how it happened.
Right.
Ever. See a documentary if you want to be closer to how it exactly happened. But if you're watching,
and even then,
but if you're watching a movie, throw what actually happened out the window, do your research afterwards, enjoy the movie for what it's trying to tell you using this true event as a launching pad. And I say that primarily because my favorite part of the movie is kind of completely made up. The student paper did do a piece on the Alice Janney character, writing some sort of letter or something that was kind of key in some other investigative journalists at actual newspapers, you know, kind of digging into this. But there was no Rachel. or whatever her, I think her name was Rachel. There was no meeting, you know, where he was like, you should do better journalism. Like that never, you know, happened in any way, shape or form. And by all accounts, they were so blatant with this that it didn't really take much of an investigative journalist to bring. Like that part is true. They just bought whatever they wanted on the school card and just thought nobody would ever, you know, dig in and pay attention from what I can tell. The other part that I think is interesting to think about, interesting to talk about, and worth a discussion at some point, maybe not here today, but is Frank's sexuality. Because he has said often that he is attracted to both men and women. He never considered himself a closeted homosexual. In fact, he said he was out when all this was happening, that people knew that he had a homosexual relationship and that his partner knew that they were in an open situation. Yep. and all that stuff. So there's a really interesting thing the movie is doing with taking his sexuality and making it part of the repression, the plot, the what you were saying about the character work. And I understand why the movie is doing that. But as different as it appears to be, at least from his perspective of his own sexuality and what the truth was, it's worth kind of thinking about that. And what does it mean when a movie takes a sexual preference or sexuality and shifts it a little bit to make their own points or whatever the case may be? And I, as terrible as his actions were, it's worth thinking about those things. And
well, I'm sorry. It's a weird thing that that movies have to do a lot of times, where it doesn't trust an audience. Maybe to we've just told you that he can't. He has to put up these appearances. He can't eat carbs. Mm-hmm. He's all these different lies. What does that say about our character that he's open about his sexuality? You know,
right.
It's one of those things that movies feel. I feel like they do that so that you're. But. Wait a minute, that you told me he was this thing. How can he be a lot of things?
I just think, you know, it's thematic. Like you mentioned, Chris, your first, you know, thoughts after I was done with the summary. I think this movie is about how we see ourselves and how other people see us and the identities we try to create for ourselves and the identities other people create about us and then how those compare to the truth. And so I think making his sexuality closeted in this movie, I'm not gay. I can't speak to whether or not that's something that might offend a gay person to do that for thematic reasons. But I think it was clearly done to underscore those themes of hiding who you really are from the people around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I also think it's worth pointing out there's a title card at the end of the movie that says Frank still receives $173,000 a year because of some weird frickin' New York pension loophole. And then IMDb says Pam, who died unfortunately, Pam also received $54,000 a year, and she gave half of every payment back to the school to try and repay what she stole.
Yeah, both those things appear to be true. And yeah, that was actually, I had written down for my last thing, was that's just wild that he's... It's hard for me to understand if you're in a situation where your pension is going to be almost $200,000 a year. Like, what are you stealing for? Like, what do you need? Like, there's a level of discomfort with our value as assigned by the dollar signs that I think a lot of us have to just get over. You know, like it's so hard.
Yep. It's that scene in Chinatown, right, man? Like, it's like, what can't you afford? And it's like, it's not about what you're able to afford. It's about the future, Mr. Getz. It's the future. But yeah, sometimes it's not even about the future. It's just about, I really, truly believe it's all about deserve.
Exactly.
I deserve this. And it doesn't really matter what I can use the money for. It's more about like, that's in my bank account. Look at that. That's amazing. A couple other things. I'm surprised I haven't seen some other things that Ray Romano has done since Everybody Loves Raymond and all that. But he's become a terrific dramatic actor.
Yep.
Like I've saw him in I think he was in The Big Sick. He was really good in that. And then he's been in a couple other things that have been really acclaimed. And he's great in this too. He's really, really, really sort of acts that you know, the he wants to have success, but he doesn't want to have success to the point that someone's cheating for him, you know, like he's clearly got a line. It takes a long time to get to that line, but he clearly has a line, and I love that about it. I'm gonna mispronounce her name probably, but Geraldine Viswanathan, I think is how I heard it, plays Rachel, is another terrific actor as well. Yep. And she was she's in Thunderbolts, and she's been quite a few things since then, but I really like her a lot too in this. So, and just in addition to the fact that you've got these heavy hitters like Hugh Jackman and Allison Janney in there,
she holds her own in that scene with him out at the benches where he's trying to intimidate her, and she doesn't even get much dialogue to do in that scene. She's got to do it with her face, and she's holds her own acting wise. She's great.
Yeah, absolutely love them. This is a great pairing. I would have never thought of this pairing ever. And they're just terrific together, of course, because they're just awesome professional actors. So, all right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I will go ahead and start since it has been said in the comments.
Oh, no.
Yeah, mine is The Informant. It has that same kind of tack, right? It makes us think that our main character is good throughout. And then about halfway, you're realizing, okay, well, maybe he's not as good as we think. And then by the end of it, you're like, oh, he's probably the main villain of this story.
They talk about the number he's stolen, it goes up. Every scene they mention how much he's stolen, it's increased.
Yes, exactly. And so I wanted to think of something different because I felt like it was obvious, but that kept hitting me right in the jaw every time I wanted to go something else because it just has that same kind of feel to it. And it's the same sort of deal, more money getting stolen and just, you know, like, oh, we think he's the good guy all the way through this. And then we realize, oh, he's just been feeding us a line of shit, just like he's been feeding everybody else a line of shit. So anyway, there you go.
Good call.
My double feature is one of those double features that at the end of the day you pick because you just want people to watch the movie and nobody has watched the movie. But also there are some similar themes. It's kind of the other side of it. I went with The Teacher's Lounge. Now, I don't know if either of you got around to seeing this. This came out the end of 2023. It's either a German film or a French film. I think it's a German film. But it is about a teacher who is trying to do the right thing, and it's kind of The Road to Hell is Paved with Good Intentions, the movie. And it's like, it's a really interesting look at how do you navigate parents who think their kids are everything, and how do you actually be a good teacher in a situation like what happens in this movie that I won't spoil.
Gal was in September 5. She played the translator in September 5, so it was German then.
I think it was a German film. It is a German film, not very many people watch this movie. It's on Netflix. It's on Netflix right now. You know, fire it up. Teacher's Lounge is worth a watch.
See you later, guys.
All right, thanks. I'll take it.
Maybe I'll reinstate my Netflix subscription for this.
There you go.
No, that sounds like a really good movie. I will need to see that at some point. All right, let's go on to what our homework is next week, and it's Aaron's turn. Aaron, what do you got for us?
Well, I promised that I would continue the Hugh Jackman of it all, so I'm going to go with one of his films, one of the best-known Hugh Jackman films. Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl.
Is he in that movie?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Pay attention. He is.
Mm-hmm. Is it a cameo?
So me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, if you want to we're going to check that out. Go deeper. I love this movie. I absolutely adore the way this movie handles the subject matter that it's handling. Plus, it has a great cast. Nick Offerman, Connie Britton, John Bernthal, Molly Shannon are all in this. And as mentioned, Hugh Jackman.
And I love Olivia Cooke so much.
Yes. Olivia Cooke is great.
I remember this was whoever the author of this book was right alongside us when Jeremy was signing his Abel's books.
Yes. Jesse Andrews.
And getting a lot more people in line than I was getting to.
Yeah. I mean, that was the hotness when we went out to do that.
It sure was.
That book was just red hot, and it was being turned into the movie at the time, I believe, that we were sitting there. And also, we had Nick Offerman to our right. That was a lot of fun.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah. All right, looks like we have time for one question.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
A lot of times we hear about people rewatching in adulthood a movie they loved as a child and it not holding up at all. Do you have any experiences of the reverse of a movie you thought was lame as a kid but now think is great? I had a hard time with this question. But not so much as a kid, because any movie I thought was lame has usually held up as lame when I was a kid and like watched it later or whatever. And you know, so I've had a lot of the movies that I thought were awesome turned out to be lame. But probably the biggest turnaround I've ever had on a movie is Pan's Labyrinth. I didn't like that movie, and I think I didn't like it for just a lot of, you know, just silly reasons. And then ultimately I watched it again. I forced myself to watch it again, and I really, really liked it. I'm not a big Guillermo del Toro fan in general, but I felt like I probably gave this one short shrift, and I really liked it on the second roll around. And then probably the youngest I was watching a movie I thought was lame was Starship Troopers, because I didn't really get it. I didn't get what Paul Verhoeven was going for in Starship Troopers. And then over time you start hearing what people think of that movie and what the themes of the movie are about. And you're like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. I don't know if it's great after you tell me that. It's kind of like Showgirls. You know, I don't think it's great after you've told me this, but I do like it. I do appreciate it more. So anyway, what do you guys think?
I guess, do I ever answer a question traditionally? This isn't one that I saw as a child and thought was lame, but then as an adult saw it again and thought was great. But something that I watched regularly over the years from childhood to adulthood that I started out hating and grew to love. And that's a 70s musical, Scrooge, with Albert Finney. And it is a Christmas Carol. And as a kid, I didn't know any of the actors, and there were songs, and I didn't like it. It felt epically long, too long, and every year, Mom and Dad would put it on and show it to us, probably trying to teach us morality or some shit like that. And as I got older, late high school, early college, I not only started to recognize the actual quality of the film, this is the same time I'm becoming a film buff, right? My brothers come home from college and introduce me to some awesome movies. I'm sneaking out to the theater without my dad knowing. And so as I start to watch it as a film and as a new film lover, instead of something that was hoisted upon me in my childhood, I start to appreciate the quality of Albert Finney's acting, the quality of the songwriting, the cinematography, the tone choices. And so now it's something that I again watch annually on my own. Mm. It is really long, still. But I have come to thoroughly love it. It's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, this was hard for me too. You know, a lot of times you'd think this would be like, you know, older movies, but I fell in love with older movies. Or like you said, you know, Jeremy, like musical. I loved musicals as a kid or whatever. The one, though, that I just never really got was Field of Dreams. I was 14 when it came out. By the time it was on video, which, again, I didn't go to movies and movie theaters until later in life. So, you know, I was like, yeah, I guess, yay, baseball. I don't know. Like, it didn't really hit me in any kind of interesting way. And then I remember seeing it later in life and go, oh, this is about fathers and sons. And like, I was expecting, you know, Hoosiers, but on the baseball field or, you know, something. I was expecting a sports movie, and it's not a sports movie. Even though, you know, it's about a baseball field. So yeah, that one kind of came back to me. I was like, oh, I see the craft here. I see what's going on. This is, you know, really well done. So that's the one that I came up with.
You should have known when he said, is this heaven? And he's like, no, this is Iowa. Nothing is as it seems.
That's right.
What you should have kind of taken from that. I should have had the message. Quick rundown of the chat. Nolan says, I thought Titanic was lame as a kid. That's okay. You can think it's lame as an adult, too. Lollipop Shoes, I love Pan's Labyrinth. I think it was mismarketed and people didn't know what to expect. I think that's true. Nolan says, I thought Rango was bad also, and I haven't gotten around to watching again, but everyone says it's great. I don't like Rango either. R1MA78 says, I thought Arsenic and Old Lace was lame. How dare you? My dad loved it, but I never watched more than 5 minutes in the 80s. I think that means you like it now, maybe? Tatsu says, Mulan 2, I hated it at first, but now it's my third favorite Disney of all time, although I wasn't a kid. Wow. Mulan 2. Castro says, I want to say Fantastic Mr. Fox, but I haven't actually rewatched it yet. Please rewatch that movie, Castro. Fantastic Mr. Fox is great. Josh Zero says, I'm going to go with The Wizard of Oz. When I was a kid, this was eye-rolling bullshit. Then my wife made me watch it again in the late 2000s, and then I got it. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see, also he says, Enemy Mine with Dennis Quaid. Thought it was just a knockoff of Star Trek or Wars, but yeah, it's okay, not blowing my balls off or anything, but not bad. And then Lollipop says, Rosemary's Baby. Teen me did not understand it and thought it was slow. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much, chat, for coming out. We appreciate you so much. Next week is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Can't wait to watch that. I have never seen it. Oh. Yeah, that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time.
See
you.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I was posting today's video for CinemaSins, and it's Dog Man. I'm excited to see how that does. But this is a kid's cartoon that is about a policeman and a dog that are in such a horrific accident that they have to combine their body parts into a dog man. And so I briefly flirted this morning putting it in the horror playlist. I just thought that would be hilarious, but...
It reminds me, I don't know, a long time ago when we did Life of Pi, and like nearly everything at the end of it was like, oh, maybe none of that happened.
Yeah. And then, it was all metaphor. It was all his imagination of actual people as animals. And yeah.
Richard Parker!
Hardly any of that happened. Hardly any of that stuff that Kevin Spacey does in Usual Suspect happened.
Yep. Yeah.
I remember watching, I had the Laserdisc of Usual Suspects, and there was commentary on it. And of course they're very tight-lipped about, both Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie were very tight-lipped about what happened in the movie. And at the very end, after everything is said and done, you hear Bryan Singer say, well, you wonder, everybody's asking us, so what really happened in this movie? And as he says that, Christopher McQuarrie's commentary overlaps Bryan Singer's in a very deliberate way. And when Christopher McQuarrie starts saying something that you might hold on to, Bryan Singer's comes in. And it's just, it's commentary much like the movie itself.
Wow. That's kind of cool. Amazing. We watched, one of the movies we watched when my brother was here, was Anatomy of a Fall. And I did not pick up what the movie was doing until it had ended. And my American procedural drama trained brain was like, wait, you're not going to tell me? And then my brother was like, he quoted the movie from like 30 minutes earlier where the gal says to the boy, if you don't know the answer, you just make it up for yourself. You decide for yourself, you know, what, mm-hmm. what it is. And I was like, oh, I instantly love this movie now. so it was just, it didn't click for me until my brother made that connection. And I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I decide this happened.
So. I've always had a weird relationship with those movies because these movies like A Serious Man and, where there's no way to really know certain things. Mm. And it plays with us in this modern day where we feel like we should know everything. We have video of everything. We have audio of everything. And then we come up onto a situation where there is no concrete evidence of anything. What do we do in that instance? Because we don't have the evidence that we need, we crave, and everything. So I love the movies for exploring it, and then I hate the movie for not giving me an answer that it thinks it is.
Yeah,
you know. And so, like, you know, it's I love Anatomy of a Fall. I love that movie.
My brother paused it halfway through and he was like, who do you think did it? And I was like, I think the kid did it.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's the one. I know there has been one recently, but I think that might be the one. Was it Trier, I think was the director's name, said something along the lines of, there is an answer. It's just not my responsibility to tell you the answer. Like, there, like, not that the movie indicates a specific answer, but in the real world there is clearly something that happened.
Yeah.
And we are meant to interpret what we see to try to figure out what happened in the real world. And I know she told the actress to play that part as innocent. So Sandra Hüller, her perspective was, I'm innocent. But that does not mean that she is actually innocent in the real world. So it's interesting stuff.
That flashback to the argument they have when they start out playing the audio in court and then they flash back to the argument. That is one of the best written marital arguments I've ever seen on film. They both make solid points and they're both super wrong at times. And emotion comes into it. So they're both pulling up things from the past. It felt so authentic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And American Psycho is another one like that.
Where it doesn't tell you.
Doesn't tell you if this, I mean, I think we're supposed to believe that this is all in his head by the end. I think the movie kind of directs you that way, but I remember from the trivia, Willem Dafoe was directed to, in some instances, believe that Christian Bale committed murders and acted that way. And then in the other ones, he was instructed to be like, whatever, you're just somebody I'm talking to. And so they mixed and matched all those Willem Dafoe scenes in American Psycho so that you're just like, does he think that he killed anybody or what? That's another fascinating movie. The other day when Spaceballs 2, I saw somebody on a text message gave me a thing that showed Spaceballs 2, and somebody asked, is this a real thing? And he's like, yep, it's a real thing. And I went to the IMDb and couldn't find Spaceballs 2 anywhere, but there it was on the internet, a whole trailer for Spaceballs 2.
Yeah.
That Mel Brooks introduced himself. I think that was just a case of like brand new news that they hadn't gotten to yet. But
Mel Brooks, man, is he 100 yet?
No, but he's definitely in his 90s.
Yeah, it's wild.
I don't know what year he turns 100.
I've never seen Spaceballs all the way through.
Oh,
that's darn right crazy.
I've only ever seen scenes. You know, if you put balls in the title of your movie, then Jeremy's growing up house is not going to show that movie.
That's interesting. Have you seen Mel Brooks' other stuff? Like,
oh yeah,
oh yeah, you I've just never got Saddles around to that one. Okay,
Robin Hoodman in Tights. I just never got. I went over back to it. I've seen scenes, the famous scenes. Your Schwartz is as big as mine, and the dancing alien, and all that stuff. I know the pop culture stuff from it. I've just never sat down and watched it beginning to end.
My favorite part is when they're watching the movie they're in And it's caught, and they catch up to the part of the movie that they're actually at, and they're looking over their shoulders at the camera as they're watching.
That's funny.
So good.